Okay, we're now recording and all your microphones are muted, but if you want to ask me a clarifying question, just unmute your microphone. I'll be able to hear you and everyone else will be able to hear you. But let me go into the share feature now and okay, all of you should be seeing my first slide, which simply is letting you know all the different ways you can communicate with us at Reasons to Believe. All of our scholars at Reasons to Believe have a personal Facebook and Twitter page that they use for ministry purposes only, and you're welcome to ask some questions on either of those venues. And just to kind of do a quick review for those of you joining, because a lot of you are new, is that what we talked about a few weeks ago is that there are three main pillars of Christianity that if they were proven to be incorrect would be catastrophic to the Christian faith, would actually prove that Christianity is not true. I mean, for example, if we were to prove that the universe did not have a beginning, that would imply that there's no cosmic creator. And so proof that the universe had no beginning would be catastrophic to the Christian faith. Likewise, if we were to prove that we human beings are no different than the rest of life on planet Earth, that we don't have the image of God, we're not exceptional relative to all other life forms, that would be catastrophic to the Christian faith. And if we were to prove that Jesus did not rise bodily from the dead, this is something that Paul talked about in Corinthians, that if this were to be proven incorrect, then none of us would have eternal life, and we would be pitied for believing a lie. But one reason why I featured these three pillars is that if we were to prove that these are true, they would establish that Christianity is correct. And incidentally, all this came out of a debate I had with a British chemist, Peter Atkins. And all you need to do is go on YouTube and put in my name, Hugh Ross, and Peter Atkins, it'll pop right up. You can watch the debate. And the debate really focused on, is there any scientific evidence that would cause you to change your position? And these are the three I mentioned that would cause me to change my position. But Peter Atkins, the atheist, when asked if there's any scientific evidence that would cause him to change his position, he declined to give any examples. Although he did say, well, if Jesus were to appear right in front of me, that would be impressive, but I would chalk that up to just being delusional and just I had some something wrong with my brain. So the bottom line was evidence really wasn't a factor, even though for an hour in the debate he said we have to base our beliefs on scientific evidence. But I picked up on this, and what we're doing is basically focusing on number two. How can we use science to show that the Bible got it right and what it says about human beings, looking at the book of nature to support what the book of scripture says? You know, the book of scripture is replete with the fact that we humans are the product of special creation. We're not the product of naturalistic evolution or common descent. The Bible is explicit that God specially created Adam and Eve from the dust of the earth. So we're not the product of descent from, say, a common ancestor of the chimpanzees. The Bible is also explicit that humans and humans alone possess the image of God, and that humans alone ask the God question, you know, is there a God? And humans alone possess the capacity to form a relationship with God, not only discover that God exists, but to enter into an emotional, spiritual relationship with God and have him direct your life and give you guidance throughout your life. And so what we've done in the past couple of weeks, oh, by the way, if you want to dig into this in more depth than you probably care to dig, Buzz Ron and I wrote a book called Who is Adam? It's now in a second edition, 400 pages long. So if you want to really dig into what the scientific literature is saying about human origins and how we respond to atheists and theistic evolutionists, who argue against some of these biblical principles, you can get that book. And you can also get this book that I wrote, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job. I talk not only about human exceptionalism, but the exceptionalism of the nephesh animals. Nephesh is a Hebrew word meaning soulish. It's a reference to birds and mammals and a handful of the higher reptilian species that are capable of forming an emotional and bonded relationship with human beings and actually being able to be tamed and domesticated by humans to serve and please humans in a sacrificial way. And you know, often what happens is non-theists look at the exceptionalism of these bird and mammal species and therefore think, well, we're no different. We have the same features. Yes, we do, but we got features that go beyond what they possess. So the Bible teaches not only human exceptionalism, it also teaches the exceptionalism of the nephesh or the soulish animals. And something we did in late January is we featured a workshop at Reasons to Believe at our headquarters, where we invited leading atheist experts in human origins, and theistic evolutionary experts, to challenge us on our biblical model of human origins. And so video recorded the whole thing. If you go to reasons.org/human-origins-workshop, you can watch the presentations and also the panel challenges that the presenters had, basically looking at the spectrum of models in human origins. And you can see for yourself how well our model stood up to scientific critique from those who took different positions. And then what we've been looking at is just the scientific evidence, a brief survey of the scientific evidence. Are we humans actually exceptional? Or what you see in the secular scientific literature, that we're merely the product of common descent from a common ancestor with the chimpanzees and the Neanderthals. And these are some of the evidences we gave for a human exceptionalism. Again, if you want to see this described, just go back to, I think this is 2 weeks ago that we went through this, and it's recorded. So I'm not going to go into this in detail, but we looked at 10 different features of human behavioral expression that shows that we're different from all other animal species on the face of the earth, not only those that share the planet with us today, like the chimpanzees and the orangutans, but how we're distinct from Neanderthals, the Denisovans, the Erectines, the Australopithecines. We alone possess these features. And I'll actually talk a little later today about some of the challenges that have come from this, from people who have been studying Neanderthals. And then last week, we looked at the morphology. That's a term for the physical bodily structure of human beings and how that's distinct from all other species of life, including the bipedal primate species that preceded us. So for example, we've got this skull that's shaped differently than any other primate, alive or extinct. And then we have this frontal globular capacity to accommodate a very large parietal lobe. And it's that lobe of our brain that enables us to do mathematics, symbolic expression, inventiveness, philosophy, theology. This is that part of the brain that actually supports the image of God. And we had this unusual hand dexterity where we talked last week how we were actually endowed with dexterity in our hands at the beginning of human existence that really didn't have application until just the last couple of centuries. For example, early humanity, Adam and Eve, did not really need the hand dexterity to be able to type 100 words a minute on a computer. But God knew that there would come a time when we'd all be trapped in our homes, where the only way we could communicate would be through computers and technology, and endowed us with a hand dexterity in advance so we could do this. And who hasn't enjoyed a symphony, Mozart, a Liszt piano concerto, for example? And we can only do that because of very amazing hand dexterity. The fact that we take 24 years for women and 25 years for men to go from out of the womb to being fully developed. And it's that long period of development that allows us to achieve such high mental capabilities, and how we humans strip all other forms of life and our metabolic rate and our lifespan. We go through 4 times as many heartbeats as any other species on the face of the earth. So we're able to be highly functional and very active, literally for many decades, the only species of life that's able to do that. Then we looked at the fact that we have a high encephalization quotient. That refers to how much your brain weighs compared to the rest of your body mass. Now, this is assuming, of course, that you don't suffer from obesity. So a normal body weight, what we see is that, yes, Neanderthals' brains were as massive as our brains, but their bodies were a lot more massive than our bodies. If you look at the ratio of our brain mass to our body mass, we outstrip them by quite a wide margin. And then our high leg to height ratio, this allows us to be able to survive in a high heat environment, our slender skeletal frame, the fact that we have very little body hair, and the fact that we have this perspiration system that's extremely efficient, enables us human beings to survive in a high heat, high humidity environment. And actually, I mentioned last week how humans were actually able to outcompete predators like lions and tigers and cheetahs because we could hunt in the heat of the day based on the fact that we have this body that receives very little sunlight because we're bipedal and we're slim and we got this long leg to height ratio and we have very little hair, which means that we're able to, we don't retain heat like these other animals do. And then we got this incredible perspiration system. So that's kind of where we left off last week. What I want to go right now is into the fact that we have unique genes and unique gene expression. And I'm going to mention this simply because this has been the kind of the core of the debate that's been going on amongst Christians, theistic evolutionists, evolutionary creationists, young earth creationists, and our model of human origins of reasons to believe. These are all different models of human origins under the Christian umbrella, but it's genetics that has really been the area of division amongst these different camps, where, for example, evolutionary creationists and theistic evolutionists would claim that the genes that we human beings possess are simply the product of natural descent from a common ancestor with the Neanderthals and the chimpanzees. And my colleague, Faisal Rana, our biochemist, has been writing numerous articles challenging this presumption that our genes are the product of natural descent rather than special creation. And then some of the latest stuff that he's been writing about, how when you look at the Neanderthal genes and compare them with human genes, what we see is that there are 766 Neanderthal genes that have got different gene expression. And so a lot of people have been focusing on the fact that Neanderthal genome is 99% the same as human genome. Now, that's the part that we can compare. We don't have the entire Neanderthal genome, nor do we have the entire human genome. But the parts that we have, when we compare them, are 99% similar. Now, my colleagues here at Reasons to Believe don't think that that 99% is going to hold up for the entire genomes of both. It's going to be less, but the part that we can compare, it's about 99% similar, which has led people to say, well, that proves we must have a common ancestor because of how similar they are. But what Faisal Rana has been pointing out is that it's not just the genes you need to look at, you need to look at the gene expression. And this is where we see significant difference between humans and Neanderthals is in the gene expression. And it's interesting too, where we see the difference in the gene expression. So a lot of our genes get expressed at different times. I mean, consider this. We humans take 24 to 25 years to fully develop from the time that we're born to when we're fully functional. And what governs that are genes turning on and off at specific times throughout the developmental period. So, I mean, we're all aware, for example, that with males, human males, facial hair begins to kick in when they're about 12, 13, or 14. That's an example of a gene being expressed at a particular time during the development. But when you look at the places where we see a difference in gene expression between Neanderthals and humans, what is really interesting is where you see it is in the immune response system, the cardiovascular system, the skull system, and the skeleton. And as we looked at last week, this is where we see the morphological differences between humans and Neanderthals. Incidentally, the list we gave you last week, a lot of you asked me, is that a complete list? No, it's just a partial list. We have many more morphological differences than just the ones I shared with you last week. For example, Neanderthals have a barrel-shaped chest. When you look at their rib cage, instead of it being kind of cylindrical, it's kind of conical. And so Neanderthals are much wider than we were. They had shorter legs. And all this was designed to enable them to retain body heat. And they had fur. They weren't naked like we are. And so they had a much better capacity to retain body heat than we did. And as we mentioned last week, our Creator designed us with a body that can withstand high heat and high humidity, because our Creator knew that with our big brain and our hand dexterity, we could easily develop the clothing that we needed to keep us warm when the temperature dropped. And so, given that we have the capacity for clothing technology, there, obviously, from a Creator's perspective, He would design our bodies to be able to handle high heat conditions, knowing that we could easily adapt to cold conditions. But creatures like the Neanderthals that did not have the brain or the dexterity to make clothing, they needed to have some way to keep their bodies warm, and therefore they had the fur, they had the short legs, the short limbs, the barrel shape, in order to be able to retain body heat. And I think I mentioned this last week too. We do have evidence that humans very quickly were living in climate zones 15 degrees colder than what the Neanderthals could live in. And so that's evidence that humans developed clothing technology quickly. You actually see that in the Genesis chapter 3, that here we got Adam and Eve, and they're developing clothing right from the get-go. And so this, again, is another example. We humans, unlike the Neanderthals, the Denisovans, the Erectines, were able to very quickly develop technology. And so, and then, again, if you look at the point, the second point there, 588 genes in humans, 45 to 7,000 years ago. What they did here is they found humans that have been dead for 7,000 years up to 45,000 years. There actually are about a dozen different human skeletons that have been discovered in this age range. And we've been able to recover DNA, not completely, but completely enough to be able to demonstrate that there are 588 genes in humans that have unique DNA methylation relative to the Denisovans and the Neanderthals. And again, this is what we mean by methylation, is the idea of them being able to function when they're needed. And what's interesting here is that we see these genes most frequently with respect to the larynx, the pelvis, and the face. And in terms of the face and the larynx, this is basically making the point that the morphology of human beings is unique in that it's designed for complex language communication. We have a larynx and a face and a tongue like no other species that enables us, for example, to develop a vocabulary of 50,000 words. And, you know, there are people that can speak in multiple languages. And so we have the capability, thanks to the way our face is structured and our mouth and our larynx, that it is actually possible for us to speak quickly with a very large vocabulary. And this is unique to human beings. You don't see this with the parrots, who are able to mimic quite a few of our words. We don't see this with any other primate. And you say, what about the pelvis? Well, what's unique about the human pelvis, it enables the human females to be able to give birth to a baby that has a large brain. And so, I mean, any of you who've watched your children come out of the womb, as I have, are struck by just how big the head is relative to the rest of the body. This is so that this newborn baby can begin to function intellectually at quite an early level. And what's also unique about human beings is how big their brain is at birth relative to the adult brain. The human brain grows by a factor of 3 from the time of birth till full development. But it takes a particular pelvic structure of the human female to be able to give birth to a baby that has such a large head and such a large head to body ratio. And so this again is evidence that we humans are not the product of common descent, natural common descent, but rather that of a special creation. And I'd like to commend to you an article that my colleague Faisal Rana wrote just this past week. All of us had reasons to believe who are on the Scholar team write blogs. I write one every week. The other scholars write one about every couple of weeks, sometimes more frequently. But Fuzz Rana came out with this particular blog last week, and it was titled New Pseudodome Function. Let me bring this back. Here we go. I wonder if I forgot to. See if this works. Okay. I'm going to, tell you what. What happened is I forgot to put the click feature in for that. But the title of the article is New Pseudogene Function Smiles on the Case for Creation. And actually, it's got a title in front of it called New Joke, because Buzz wrote this on April Fool's Day. So he tells a couple of Fool's Day jokes in there. But it's all about pseudogene function. And this is part of the debate we had with the scholars, the scientists at BioLogos. By the way, if you want to go into this in detail, we did a two views book with BioLogos that was put out by InterVarsity Press. And you can get that at the bookstore at reasons.org, where we kind of debated our different positions. And most of the debate had to do with these genes in humans relative to genes in the bipedal primates. Now, the big part of the debate is we have what they call these pseudogenes, which is a term for fake gene. And our theistic evolutionary friends have basically been arguing these are genes that serve no function. And if they serve no function, the most reasonable explanation is that it's simply an evolutionary mistake that was passed on to succeeding the species as they evolved. What we're claiming at Reasons to Believe is that these pseudogenes do have function, and the problem is we've been looking for function in the wrong place. And so this is Fuzz's latest article on pseudogenes. He's written many of them that you can find at reasons.org. But this is his latest article where he talks about all the recent discoveries about functions for these genes that are presumed to have been genetic mistakes that were the product of naturalistic evolution. Incidentally, just to give one a small caveat, because we live in a universe with a second law of thermodynamics, which according to Romans 8 pervades the entire universe, everything is decaying, we would expect a small amount of genetic decay in the present human genome simply because we've been on planet Earth for a few tens of thousands of years, but it'd be a very small level. Thermodynamics would only degrade it a tiny amount, and evolutionary biologists have been claiming a huge amount of decay. We would argue there's just a tiny amount of decay. In fact, we'd argue we'd get to document any indisputable decay in the human genome. Every time we look, we see evidence that these things have function. And it's similar to what happened years ago when people thought that our appendix had no function. And that was because the appendix is attached to our digestive tract, and people were looking for a digestive purpose for the appendix. And what we recognize is it had no digestive purpose, but does play an important role in the human immune response system. And this is similar with these pseudogenes. Excuse me. In that the function is not where we thought it would, but if you look, you actually do find that it has function. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that we humans have a long development time. So yes, we got a lot of these pseudogenes because of the fact we need a lot in order to be able to govern the development of human beings from the time they're born until they're fully functional. Now, what I wanted to do in the remaining 5 minutes I've got is to actually look at Neanderthal technology, because this has been a huge part of the debate. Is Neanderthal just as technologically capable of we human beings? And what I'm noticing is that if you look at the secular anthropological scientific literature, they are claiming that Neanderthals are fully human and that the Denisovans are fully human. And many are claiming that Homo erectus is fully human. And then you've got people in the young earth community who claim that Adam was created by God, but he is the father of Neanderthals, Denisovans, Homo erectus, as well as the current human population. And a number of evolutionary theistic evolutionists also hold the same view. And what we discovered when we held our Human Origins workshop at Reasons to Believe is apparently we at Reasons to Believe stand alone in taking the position that only modern humans are the ancestors of Adam and Eve. We alone take the position that Neanderthals, the Denisovans, Homo erectus, and the other erectines are not human. Only so. What I want to do is just spend a few minutes actually going through with you the scientific literature that's being touted or cited to claim that Neanderthals are just as fully human as we are. And the first of these are the evidence for burial ceremonies. Now, when you look at the scientific literature, this is based on the fact that they find a portion of a Neanderthal skeleton that's been buried. And then 20, 30 feet away, they find things like flower pollen. And so they surmise what was going on is a Neanderthal died. His compatriots had a burial ceremony for him. They buried him, and they were throwing flowers on the grave, just like we would do when we bury one of our loved ones who has passed away. And my colleague Faisal Rana has commented on this. And by the way, he's not unique. Many non-theistic anthropologists also say this is not evidence that they were engaged in any kind of sophisticated cultural activity. They would argue that there isn't even evidence that this was a purposeful burial. It could be that this Neanderthal skeleton was buried naturally, and that this flower pollen we have found just happened to be there by accident. It was not evidence, for example, of a bunch of Neanderthals going around a circle of their dead compatriot and putting flowers on top of their body. That's a possibility, but it's a remote possibility. And we have many secular papers that we cite that say we don't see this as evidence. Moreover, we do see in animals alive today that they conduct similar activities, not that they're spiritual in nature, but they're soulish in nature. Example being that when a matriarch elephant dies, when you think about the elephant's behavior, is you've got this older female elephant, and she kind of leads a group, an extended family group, and she's old enough to remember where all the water holes are and the routes that need to be taken to get there. And so there's a strong bond between this extended family of elephants and the matriarchal elephant. And when she dies, the elephants that are part of her group grieve for her, and that will basically pace around the dead matriarch and heap straw over her body until her body is covered with straw. And this is not, we would argue, an expression of some belief that these elephants have, that the matriarch elephant is going to experience eternal life, rather as an expression of loss, of grief. They've been emotionally bonded to this matriarch elephant. That bond has been broken, and so they're expressing their grief. And by the way, this is not unique to elephants. Many bird and mammal species go through this grief experience. In fact, just a few months ago, there was a coyote couple in our neighborhood where one of them had passed. And literally for days on end, the surviving coyote would stand over the body and howl in grief over the passing of its partner. And in our own family, we had a dog and a cat that were bonded very much together. We would take the dog out for a walk every night, and the cat without a leash would accompany us and walk shoulder to shoulder with that dog. And loved to play with the dog. They would box one another playfully. And then the dog passed, and our surviving cat literally spent 40 days and nights mourning the loss of its compatriot. So it even happens where they can grieve the loss of a different species, providing that they're emotionally bonded to that one. As I mentioned last week too, the only examples we see of birds and mammals bonding to one another emotionally, where they form these relationships with one another with their different species, is when both are bonded to a higher being, namely one of us human beings. The second piece of evidence is the claim that Neanderthals in particular had control of fire. And this is based on the fact that they see evidence that Neanderthals were using fire to roast food, and in particular to roast food in such a way that they could harvest the food that they couldn't harvest without a fire. And so this evidence has been cited as proof that just like us human beings, they were able to control fire to keep warm and to use it for cooking purposes, etc. And again, these claims have been disputed, not just by those of us who are followers of Jesus Christ, but by anthropologists who are not theists, basically making the point that the evidence is being cited is not any different than the evidence we have for chimpanzees. Because as scientists have observed chimpanzees in the wild, they note that they take advantage of wildfires. So if a wildfire gets started, the chimpanzees will gather up all the nuts that they have and throw these nuts on the fire. And then they run away from the fire. But when the fire is over, they come back and they harvest the nuts. And these are nuts that they're not able to break open unless they've been heated by a hot fire. And so these chimpanzees are aware, hey, we can't crack open these nuts, not even with the stones that we use, because we do see chimpanzees trying to crack nuts with stones, but there are nuts that are so hard they can't be cracked open with stones, but they can if they've been heated by a fire. And so we don't look at chimpanzees as controlling fire, but they are able to opportunistically take advantage of wildfires. And the evidence we see with Neanderthals is that it's no different than we see with chimpanzees. So they were able to opportunistically take advantage of fire, but we're not building hearths or baking bread or using fire to keep warm and maintain heat in their domiciles, etc. Well, I see that I've gone a little bit past 30 minutes. I'm going to stop here. We'll pick this up next week, because this is really the core of the debate that we've been having with theistic evolutionists and evolutionary creationists and atheists and agnostics over whether or not we human beings are the product of special creation by God or simply the result of naturalistic evolution. And that won't happen next week, because next week is Sunday. We're taking that Sunday off, but 2 weeks from today, we'll pick it up from here. And so right now I'm going to stop the share feature. Let me
question.
Yeah, just a sec. Let me get out of the share feature. Okay, and now we are back where we can all see one another. I've got your microphones muted, so if you want to ask a question, unmute your microphone. If
Yes.
you're using a computer, just go to the lower left. If you're using a phone or some other device, you'll see a place where you can unmute your phone. Okay, who's the first one to ask a question?
Yes, I am. My name is Ruth from Rancho Cucamonga. Those
Where are you from, Ruth?
Rancho Cucamonga, California.
Very good. And what do you do for a living?
I have been teaching for over 20 years.
Very good. Okay. And incidentally, anyone who asks a question, same thing. Give us your name, where you're from or where you're operating from, and what your occupation is. Okay. What's your question?
Yes, those people who believe that Neanderthals are 100% human, do they have any biblical evidence that they use?
Well, the biblical evidence they cite, and incidentally, you'll see this in the Two Views book we did with BioLogos. It's also in the Four Views book, Four Views on Creation, Evolution, and Intelligent Design, that was put out by Zondervan, is that they would take things like God created Adam from the dust of the earth, and they would make the point that Carl Sagan made, hey, we're all made out of stardust. I mean, stars make the dust of the earth. And so they would say that that reference in the Genesis 2 is simply a reference to the fact that, we're made out of the dust of the stars and the earth. And that, however, we would argue when you look at Genesis chapter 2, it uses the Hebrew word yatsar for God making Adam and Eve from the dust of the earth. And that verb yatsar, has the combined meaning of the verbs bara and asa that you see in Genesis 1. When you go to Genesis 1, it says that God created human beings and that God made human beings. And this word bara used in Genesis 1 means to make something brand new that did not exist before. And the word make is to manufacture. But that verb asa is basically used for God basically manufacturing something personally to make something that otherwise would not happen. We're talking God controlling the natural process. What we see in Genesis 1, it uses the verb hayah. So the three verbs that are used in Genesis for God creating human beings are bara, asa, and yatsar. And I would argue that all three of those verbs eliminate the possibility that we human beings are the product of natural common descent, because all three of those verbs imply supernatural intervention. And basically making the point, there's two kinds of supernatural intervention, where God was manufacturing us, and I would argue that that's God making us from the dirt and the earth and making our human body. We assemble that supernaturally in the same way that we human beings take aluminum ore and we make an airplane. So we take this natural stuff, but we actually have to put our intelligence and manufacturing into it to make what we want to see. And then we humans, God breathed into us his spirit and basically making us spiritual beings. And that is something that's beyond physics and chemistry. So there's one thing about us that was manufactured from the natural stuff by God's supernatural hand. And then he endowed us beyond physics and chemistry with the spirit that's within us. But yeah, Christians who take a different view will basically argue that we need to look at that dust of the earth much more generically than we do at the reasons to believe.
Thank you.
Okay.
Hi, I had a question.
Yeah. Okay, Karina, tell us, give us your name, where you're from. And what's your occupation?
Yeah, my name is Karina Mauco. I'm from Venezuela,
Mm-hmm.
but right now I'm in Mexico and I'm an astrophysicist.
Very good. So we share the same occupation. That's terrific. Yeah, what's your
Yes.
question?
Yeah, my question is, I've been talking a lot with young creationists, and they always said to me that Adam is a problem for an old Earth view. So they say, how can you explain that Adam was created old And why cannot God create a universe that seems to be old, but at the end it's not old?
Right. Well, Karina, what's going on here is they're looking at Adam having the appearance of age. And if Adam can be brand new with the appearance of age, why can't the universe be brand new with the appearance of age? And I've addressed this in some detail in my book, A Matter of Days, in the second edition, basically making the point that they're in error in claiming that Adam had the appearance of age. Yes, he may have been 5 to 6 feet tall, but he's different from all the rest of us. He did not come from the womb of a woman. Anyone who comes from the womb of a woman, their height would be at least a rough indicator of their age. But if you don't come from the womb of a woman, your height would be of no material evidence for age at all. God could have made Adam brand new any height he wanted. And so his height would not be evidence for appearance of age. What would be evidence for appearance of age if, for example, we were to go to Adam the moment after God created him and found that he had liver spots all over his skin? That would be evidence of appearance of age. Or if we saw that his teeth were worn down, that would be evidence of appearance of age. Or if we saw that his hair was gray, or that he had scar tissue on his body, or that he had a tan from being out in the sun, those would all be evidences of appearance of age. Of course, we don't have those evidences, but my position is God never creates with appearance of age. And so Adam, when he was newly created by God, would not have any of those evidences of age. And his height is simply not an indicator of his age. And you say, well, why did God make him a full size rather than having him as a baby and growing up as a baby? I believe it's because God wanted to establish communication with Adam and Eve very quickly. And so having Adam with a brain that's 3 times bigger than that of a baby human means that Adam would quickly be able to develop of verbal capability. And we see that in Genesis, that God and Adam were talking to one another apparently relatively quickly. And so his being full-sized right away would enable that to happen. And incidentally, young earth creationists will also cite John chapter 2 as evidence for appearance of age. This is where Jesus transformed water into wine, where the wine steward said, "This tastes of very high quality wine." And we all know that wine that's been aged has a higher taste value than wine that's brand new. However, nowhere in that text in John 2 does it tell us that Jesus artificially aged the wine. What he did is he ensured that the flavor of the wine was of that of high quality wine. So there's nothing in the text that says that it was endowed with appearance of age. And just to give you an example, there's a distillery in Japan that produces a whiskey that tastes like 30-year-old Scotch whiskey, but it's literally just hours old. And what this Japanese distillery has figured out is how to put chemicals into the whiskey to make it taste like 30-year-old Scotch. I don't know whether they sell it for the same price as 30-year-old Scotch, but they are able to make it taste like 30-year-old Scotch. And I would argue that based on what we see in the Bible, God never creates with the appearance of age. 8 times we see passages in the Bible where it tells us it's impossible for God to lie or deceive. And for God to create the universe with the appearance of age, when in fact it was relatively young, that would be deceptive. And also the Bible tells us that the book of nature reveals truth and nothing but truth. There's nothing deceptive in the book of nature. And so that's the response I would give, Karina, to my young earth friends. And one only other caveat I would add is I've had this one pushback where my young earth friends will say, but the record of nature is fallen. And they're making the mistake there in thinking that the book of nature has been tainted by human sin. And what they've been overlooking is that our interpretation of the book of nature, it's what's tainted by human sin. Likewise, it's not the Bible that's tainted by human sin. It's our interpretation of the Bible that's been tainted by human sin. So both the book of Scripture and the book of nature are the perfect, inerrant, inspired word of God, and therefore they can't contradict one another. So hopefully that'll
help.
Thank you.
Sure. Yes, thank you.
I have a question.
Yes.
My name's Scott, and I'm currently outside of Seattle. And
what do you do for a living, Scott?
I deliver babies.
Very
I'm a gynecologist.
All right.
And we are batted down here waiting for the storm, and so far the storm hasn't hit. Anyways, my question is, it's a change of topic, which you may or may not want to address right now.
Yeah, I'll take any topic. That's fine.
But is about your new book.
Yes.
I have been waiting for months and months for this thing, and it's on. I've got it on order now. But do you mind giving us like a little 10-minute summary of what the book's going to say?
Oh, sure. I mean, the subtitle of the book is A Fresh Approach. So what you're going to see in the book is not the Al Gore thing about how we have this catastrophe on our hands and that we need to deal with it through draconian economic sacrifices by nations all around the world. And it's not a denial book. So it's, I mean, that's kind of the global warming debate. You got the people who are denying it on one side saying there is no global warming, nothing to worry about. We don't have to make these economic sacrifices. The other side saying it's certainly real. And the only way we're going to be able to resolve this problem is to make significant economic sacrifices. Basically, what you see in my book, I make the point the global warming is real. But I also put it in the context that climate stability is the exception. It's not the norm. And basically document the latest measurements. Incidentally, the measurements of 18 months ago of the temperatures of the past 9,500 years, for the first time, they got really reliable measurements. So this really helps us dealing with the deniers saying, this is evidence. And incidentally, the deniers who've looked at this evidence have been converted. They're saying, yeah, now we're convinced. It's real. But what it's showing us is that the climate of the past 9,500 years has been four times more stable than what people thought it was 3 years ago. The global mean temperature has not changed by more than 0.65 degrees centigrade over 9,500 years. The old data was saying 2 to 3 degrees. It's now stable to 0.65 degrees. But this is the only time in human history where we've seen this kind of stability. And what makes it amazing, it's happening during an ice age cycle. When you're living in an ice age cycle, the global mean temperature jumps up and down by about 15 degrees centigrade over timescales of several centuries, which explains why humans living during the last ice age were only able to develop technology in very brief spurts. The climate was so unstable, they couldn't sustain their technological advances. But the moment that the climate became stable, this is when we see human civilization and technology exponentially increase. And it's been exponentially increasing throughout the past 9,500 years. And what I show in the book is a brand new temperature profile that shows that the global mean temperature very slowly declined by 1 degree centigrade over the past 9,500 years. But over the past 70 years, it's gone up by 1 degree centigrade. So right now, we got the same global mean temperature we had 9,500 years ago. And so what was going on was that you had things like the changing tilt of the Earth's rotation axis, the changing shape in Earth's orbit, which has been working over these past 9,000 years to cool the planet. But that global cooling has been counterbalanced by human activity, which has been warming the planet. And for 9,502 years, the two have balanced one another out, giving us this extreme climate stability. In the last 70 years, we basically erase 9,500 years of a global cooling. And the concern is, if this goes on for another 70 years, the temperature may get warm enough to melt the polar ice cap. And if it melts the polar ice cap, it's going to bring on an ice age. That's something I bring out in the book. is that global warming, if you look at the past 2.5 million years, global warming has always brought on global cooling. I mean, the history of the ice age is that the temperature jumps up to about 2 to 3 degrees centigrade above where it is now, and that melts the polar ice cap. And when you melt the polar ice cap, instead of the Arctic Ocean reflecting sunlight with 60% efficiency, it reflects it with only 6% efficiency, which means all that open ocean water in the Arctic is absorbing solar heat. And when it absorbs solar heat, it creates vapor, and that vapor falls as snow on Canada and Siberia. And very quickly, Canada and Siberia can become covered with thousands of feet of ice, which cools the whole planet, and that cooling typically lasts for 90,000 years. So that's really the big thing we need to worry about. I mean, it's one thing to deal with a temperature increase, it's quite another to deal with half of North America being covered with ice.
So if is there a model that without human intervention, where would we be right now if things had just gone along a typical...
Without human intervention, we'd be deep into an ice age already.
Wow. If
human activity had stopped us from going into an ice age. The problem we're facing now is that for 9,500 years, human activity has balanced the natural cooling. Now it's out of balance. But I think where my book stands apart, I've got two chapters saying there are ways we can sustain the climate stability where we boost the world's economy rather than cripple the world's economy. And I would argue the problem with previous books, they've ignored the fact that we human beings are sinners. We're selfish. And trying to legislate draconian economic sacrifice is doomed to fail. I mean, I tried that on my sons, saying, what do you think about spending the next 50 years of your life with a standard of living that's 30% of what you have right now? And they basically said, we would rather human beings go extinct than have our economic well-being sacrificed to that degree. And even if we in the United States, for example, were to go along with these economic sacrifices, who's to say that India and China and the rest of the nations of the world are going to go along with it? People will cheat. So I argue that trying to legislate economic sacrifice is doomed to fail because it doesn't take into account the biblical principle. We human beings are sinners. But it's also ignoring another biblical principle. God commanded us in Genesis 1 and in Job 37 through 39 that we're to manage the planet's resources for the benefit of all life, for our benefit and the benefit of all non-human life, which implies we will not have to make a choice, that God has provided in advance for us solutions. Solutions that would be to our benefit as well as the benefit of all their life. And so I got two chapters of the book listing about 40 different things that we can do that would stabilize the climate and at the same time not just stabilize our economy, but boost our economy. I mean, if I tell you, hey, I got a legislation that's going to put more money in your pocket and it's going to stabilize the climate at the same time and it's going to benefit all life, who's going to vote against it? So I'm hoping to take the politics out of this debate with this book. So that's the book in a nutshell.
Hi, Hugh. Can you give me your name?
Give us your name, where you're from, and what you do.
Hi. So it's my first time, so I'm all new. I'm John Beeling. I'm actually the son of I think you met my dad, Dr. Chris Beeling, who was a professor in Hong Kong University.
Yes.
I'm living in the UK. I'm a secondary school physics teacher, so that's what I do. So my question, I don't know, I'm wondering if Reasons to Believe has considered, because I recently watched a program with S. Joshua Swamidas.
Yeah, I know who he is. He was actually part of our human origin workshop.
Yeah, and on concerning his book, The Genealogical Adam and Eve.
Right.
And basically, obviously, in his book and his new idea is obviously for an earlier Adam, compared to what you would say, like approximately 40,000 to 60,000 years in your book, navigating Genesis and obviously who was Adam. I'm just wondering, in light of the potential scientific evidences that may come for an earlier Homo sapien, shall we say, is there a potential, now this is a controversial view, a potential for Adam to not be the first human from a biblical point of view? And the where I'm coming from this is, and I could be entirely wrong, in the sense in Ephesians when God is saying that, husbands, this is Ephesians 5:25, husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. And then later on, it talks about marriage. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, obviously relating to the original Genesis account, where obviously, you know, Adam and Eve were formed originally. I'm wondering whether it's possible, because you do allude to it in your book as well, that Adam had some idea of death prior to being in the Garden of Eden. So potentially, obviously, he could have seen death from animals. One possibility, there could have been early humans that God could have created, shall we say, that he could have seen. And in this case, Adam, seeing that his wife Eve fell, he wanted to kind of like be Christ, to show that he would suffer for her. And yeah, in the same way that Christ's salvation can go to the past, Adam's death when sin entered the world could also affect the earlier humans. But I know that's quite a controversial view.
Sure.
But yeah, I'd just like to know your thoughts on that.
Well, I've read the book that Josh Swami Das produced, and I actually gave it an endorsement, but a careful endorsement, because there's parts of it that I'm not all that excited about.
Sure.
But I do agree that he is showing that there's a difference between a genealogical Adam. And basically makes the point that, like, if you were to trace your genealogy, there are certain lines that simply die out and don't pass on ancestors. Mm-hmm. So what he does in his book is make the point, well, maybe Adam could be the genealogical ancestor of all human beings without having to be the genetic progenitor of all human beings. And basically argues that this is what Genesis is teaching, that we're all descended from Adam genealogically, not necessarily genetically. Now, I would argue that the Bible actually claims both. It's not just saying that we're genealogical, particularly passages like in Acts that says that, Adam, we all come from one man, or that Eve is the mother of us all, passages like that. But my main critique of Swami Das's approach is he will claim that you can get an Adam that's a progenitor of all human beings as quickly as 6,000 years. So he's basically saying, maybe the younger creationists would be happy with this, because we can have Adam quite recent if we're talking a genealogical Adam. Or we could have the genealogical Adam go earlier to accommodate the model we have at Reasons to Believe. And it says it can even go earlier to accommodate the model that's put out by Biologos and other theistic evolutionists, where they say we think it goes back 300,000 to 500,000 years ago. So it's basically saying you can accommodate all these times. But here's the problem. You get a different genealogical Adam depending where you start tracing the genealogy. So you can trace the genealogy from today, and you can get a genealogical Adam that would be the ancestors of all of us within just a few thousand years. But if you were to do it starting 1,000 years ago, you get a different Adam. 2,000 years ago, you get a different Adam from both those positions. So that's kind of a concern for me, is that you don't get the same Adam if you start at different times. And my other concern is, it really does seem that the Bible says that Adam is not only the genealogical ancestor of all of us, He's a genetic progenitor of all of us. And yes, there are people within the Christian community that take the view that there was a much larger population of humans than just Adam and Eve, and that God selected Adam and Eve out of the population, and then through Adam and Eve, the image of God got bestowed on everyone else. I mean, in fact, there's many different views. In fact, as we've engaged biologists, we discover there's quite a diversity of views amongst the scientists and theologians of biologos exactly how they handle this issue. But where they all agree is that the ancestral population of human beings is not the biblical two, it's a larger population. I think there's a recording of a debate I had with the president of Biologos, Deborah Harzma, where we discussed this issue. Mm-hmm. And I raised the point that I'm quite a bit older than Deborah. She's only in her 40s. And I said, I can remember a time in my youth when anthropologists were saying the ancestral population of humans was 1 million. And then I saw it drop to 100,000. And when Francis Collins, the founder of Biologos, published his book, The Language of God, he was claiming 10,000. And when Faisal Rana debated the biologos geneticist Dennis Venema, Dennis said 1,200. And then we heard 800. And then Deborah said, well, we could go as low as 132. And I said, well, how about if we plot this on a graph? 1 million, 100,000. And then as we go forward in time, it drops to 10,000, 1,200, 800. It seems like it's heading towards the biblical two. Why don't we let this thing scientifically play out and see if it really does sustain the biblical two? And this is a lot of what we've written in our book, Who is Adam? Is that this evidence for a large population is assuming that present day genetic diversity amongst humans is a reliable indicator of our ancestral population. But when we do the same studies on animals, where we say take a male and female animal or mammal and put them in an isolated location. A famous experiment was done on an island in the Kerguelen Archipelago where they took two sheep, a male and a female, put them on this island where there are no other sheep on the island and let them reproduce. Then they came back, by the way, they measured their genetic diversity when they were put on the island, then measured the genetic diversity of their offspring 10, 15 generations later, and discovered that genetic diversity was far greater than the models that are used to claim that the ancestral population of humans was 10,000. And we actually cite scientific literature that basically says present day genetic diversity of any mammal species is no indicator of an ancestral population. And by the way, you have to assume an evolutionary model to get the result. If the evolutionary model is not correct, you get a different result. But the bottom line is even atheist evolutionary anthropologists are saying this is not a genetic, present-day genetic diversity is no indicator of ancestral population. Bottom line is that the biblical model that all of us are descended physically from Adam and Eve, genetically descended, is under no threat. And our colleague here at Reasons to Believe, Anjanette Roberts, she published an article and actually had it presented at this workshop where she makes the point that when God created Eve, just like with all females, when they're created, they have this set of eggs. And so the eggs, I mean, for example, when a girl is born, she is born with all the eggs she's going to have for the rest of her life. And so given that Eve is the ancestor of all of us, she could have been endowed with, say, 100 to 200 eggs, and each of those eggs could have been genetically distinct. So that would be a biblical piece of evidence that genetic diversity is no indicator of ancestral population. And so given that Eve's eggs could have been genetically distinct from one another, you can literally handle any degree of genetic diversity in the present-day human population. But again, if you want to dig into this in detail, you can go to our reasons.org website.
No, thank you so much for that. Yeah, that's really helpful. Yeah.
Okay, who's next?
I have a question.
Yeah, go for it. Give us your name, where you're communicating from, and what you do.
My name is Matt. I'm over here in southeastern Washington State. I'm a business owner in the logistics industry. But I follow your ministry. I love it. And I just had a question on dark energy. There was a new article I saw back in January from Yonsei University, if that's how you pronounce it, talking about new evidence shows that the key assumption made in the discovery of dark energy is an error. Have you seen that? You have any thoughts on that?
Yes. In fact, I've got a blog coming out on that. I forget the exact date, but the blog is written. It's been edited. It's going to be posted within a week or two. And this is all based on a paper that was published a little more than a year ago, where they claimed that there is a discrepancy between the rate at which the universe expands from the cosmic creation event based on Cepheid variable stars, which are basically looking at the cosmic expansion rate in the local universe, and basically making the point you get a different number than the one that you would derive from looking at maps of the cosmic background radiation. Now, these maps of the cosmic background radiation give you the cosmic expansion rate when the universe was 380,000 years old. But one based on Cepheid variable stars gives you the cosmic expansion rate when the universe is about a billion years old. And the difference was 9%. And so people were saying, well, there's something wrong with dark energy, or there's something wrong with our measurements, or maybe there's some undiscovered physics of the universe. Maybe we need to make an adjustment in the Big Bang creation model. This is the kind of talk that's been going on. And of course, young Earth creationists jumped on this and said, this proves that the Big Bang model is incorrect. The universe is not billions of years old. It's only thousands of years old. Now, I wrote a blog about a year ago where I made the point there's a number of ways that this discrepancy could be resolved without throwing out dark energy, without throwing out the Big Bang creation model. And basically said, for example, if you've got dark energy, it predicts that the universe will expand more rapidly today than it did when the universe was only 380,000 years old. However, the rate of more rapid expansion is only about 1%. And so that's not going to explain away 9%. But I also made the point that, the techniques that are used to measure the cosmic expansion rate could involve systematic errors, and that we need to look at that in more detail. The article I got coming out in a week or two is making the point this 9% discrepancy has now been resolved. And it got resolved by noting, number one, there's another way we can measure the cosmic expansion rate in galaxies that are nearby. Instead of using Cepheid variables to tie down the distances to these galaxies, we can use tip of the red giant branch stars. And what they've noted is that in galaxies around the universe, there are these highly evolved stars. I mean, for example, if you look at the sun, when it begins to run out of nuclear fuel, it's going to start expanding. It'll expand to such a degree that its diameter will be bigger than the orbit of the Earth. And when that happens, it'll incinerate the Earth, and it becomes a red giant. But there's a point where that red giant reaches the very tip of its maximum brightness. And so what astronomers do is they look at these red giant stars and galaxies, and they measure the one that is the most luminous. That's called the tip of the red giant branch. And what they discovered is it's the same luminosity no matter what galaxy you look at. And so these tip of the red giant branch stars are actually standard candles. And papers have been published saying these are superior standard candles to Cepheid variable stars. Because the thing with Cepheid variables is the brightness depends on their period, and their period can be influenced by a number of environmental effects. That doesn't happen with tip of the red giant branch stars. And a paper got published just a couple of months ago saying we now have a measurement of the cosmic expansion rate based on nearby galaxies. And to give you an idea, the one based on Cepheid variable stars said the universe was expanding at 74 kilometers per second per megaparsec. His measurement based on tip of the red giant branch star says it's expanding at 69 kilometers per second per megaparsec. The measurement based on the cosmic background radiation says it's a little more than 67. And then a series of papers got published saying what we've both been overlooking all these years is that our Milky Way galaxy is very near a giant void, a void that measures almost 500 million light years across. And that under density of galaxies and galaxy clusters in this nearby giant void is going to skew the measurements of the cosmic expansion rate in galaxies that are nearby, because a number of those galaxies are going to be within that void. And basically make the point, it's going to make about a 2% difference in the cosmic expansion rate. It's going to actually make the cosmic expansion rate appear about 2% greater than it otherwise would be. And then noting the fact that you get about a 1% difference between because of dark energy. Bottom line is, it's telling us that the Big Bang creation model is secure, more secure than it's ever been, and dark energy is more secure than it's ever been. Anyway, you'll see that article. I post my blogs on Mondays, and I'm not sure whether it's going to be out this Monday or next Monday, but it's going to be coming out soon. That article. And of course, I always give you links to the peer-reviewed papers so you can check out the research for yourself.
Yeah, I have a question.
Perfect. Yeah, go ahead. And again, your name, where you're communicating from, and what you do.
Hi, my name is Yuen. I live in the Netherlands, and I just recently graduated PhD.
PhD in physics, right?
No, in biology.
In biology, okay.
Behavior biology.
All right.
Yeah. So the question that I have is that in relation to the birds and mammals.
Yes.
So they are considered as nephesh. So what about fish, actually? Can fish also considered as can have grief or can show grief? And also, do the animals that engage in symbiotic relationship in the ecosystem, do they do it through an act of consciousness, or it just a random act that they are doing? For example, sea anemone and then the clownfish.
Yeah, good question. And the way the Bible defines the nephesh creatures, these are creatures that God has endowed with mind, will, and emotions. And these are creatures where the parents will sacrifice to take care of their young. And these are creatures that are able to form an emotional relationship with human beings. And when they form that emotional relationship, they'll actually sacrifice to serve the needs of their humans that they're bonded to. And all birds and mammals will do that. And the Bible also makes the point that some are more difficult to tame than others. Goats, for example, are very easy to tame, as it tells us in Job 39, whereas a hippopotamus is very difficult to tame. But people have made pets out of hippos and have been able to train hippos to be able to do service for us human beings. But the only way it can be done is if you get that hippo from the time it comes out of its mother's womb. The only time it's been successfully done is when the mother dies in childbirth and humans take over the care of that newborn hippo. There are a few reptilian species that fall into that category. Probably the best known example are crocodiles and alligators, where again, if you take the alligator from the time it comes out of its egg and it has intense human contact all the years that it's growing up, it will emotionally bond to the human and desire affection from the human, and can actually be trained by the human to do sacrificial acts for the human. But there's probably no other animal that's more challenging to tame than a crocodile. I've known people have done it, and they said, you've got to spend time with that animal every day, hours a day. You don't want to miss a day. If you miss a day, it can quickly revert into its wild nature and become dangerous. And so, and then, you know, with respect to fish, I mean, I have lots of people who have a pet fish in their tank in their living room, and the fish will get all excited when they come home.
Generally, there's a self-control overall structure and function. It is the base.
Yeah, yeah. Just let me finish, and I'll take your question, Steve. And so, I would argue that fish are not netfish creatures because we don't see them having the capacity of developing emotional relationship with human beings. They're like the rest of the non-netfish creatures. They will respond to us humans feeding them, but they're not going to do sacrificial acts to serve us as human beings. So, okay, Steve, you want to jump in?
Thanks. I'm sorry. I didn't realize I had unmuted myself. You started out with gene expression. That expression generally gives the cell control. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Steve from Monrovia. That's not Mongolia. That's near Pasadena and Monrovia. And I have residential real estate, so I try to keep my tenants happy. And my interest is in really the biblical books of Matthew and Romans, and also using early Proto-Hebrew word values to retranslate the Old Testament, especially creation accounts. I think there's a lot of potential there. The question comes with gene expression. Generally, it gives the cell control over all structure and function. It's the basis for cellular differentiation, morphogenesis, so forth, adaptability of any organism. This is not only a read-only function taking information from DNA, but is also a write to DNA function giving information from external stimuli such as environmental factors, especially at times of great environmental stress such as catastrophes. It changes DNA. So, since this is known not only as epigenetics causing changes, but also as part of extended evolutionary synthesis causing permanent changes, would RTB be open that God designed intelligent mechanisms to change for evolution, for change in evolution, such as mobile transposable elements and gene duplication, all leading to and developing higher animals and also Homo sapiens sapiens, us?
A good question, Steve, and that is part of our model, that God designs the genomes of different creatures so that they can adapt to environmental stress. Where we differ from some of our evolutionary, theistic evolutionary friends is saying that that tells the whole story. We're saying that explains adaptability. We're not saying that this explains how all life comes from a common ancestor 3.8 billion years ago. So it explains some of the evolutionary picture we see. We're saying it can't explain all of the evolutionary picture. And it would make sense from a creator perspective, is that the most efficient way to create is to create species with that kind of adaptability. And yeah, these genes do seem to actually show that adaptability to a far higher degree than we thought in the past. So thanks for pointing that out. Okay, yeah, it's 12:13. I'll take one more question before we close out, and then we'll pick this up 2 weeks from today. So,
okay.
Yeah, go ahead. Again, where you're communicating from and what you do.
Yeah, my name is Stephen Posta. I'm from the Woodlands, Texas. I'm a retired IT specialist, and my question has to do with the Milankovitch cycles that I've heard you mention before in past talks. I was wondering if you could just spend a couple of minutes explaining where we're at in the current Milankovitch cycle, and more importantly, how that might influence when the next ice age will begin for us.
Okay, good question. And this is addressed in quite a bit of detail in my new book, Weather and Climate Change. So you'll see a couple of chapters.
Just ordered it with my donation today.
Okay, good. Well, I talk in the book not only about the Milankovitch cycles of the Earth, but the Milankovitch cycles of extrasolar planets. Because any planet that exists in a system where you got gas giants, there's going to be Milankovitch cycles. I basically make the point that our Milankovitch cycles are extremely fine-tuned and are unique compared to these other planets. And where we are right now is that the tilt of the rotation axis is going down. And so it hits a peak of about 24 and a half degrees, and the minimum is about 22.1 degrees. We're at 23 and a half right now, and it's heading down towards 22. And when it heads down, that cools the planet. So based on that, we're in a cooling phase. And likewise, the shape of Earth's orbit, it's elliptical, but the degree of ellipticity changes over time. And right now, it's becoming less elliptical than it was. And when it becomes less elliptical, it cools the planet. So both Milankovitch cycles, the two most significant Milankovitch cycles, are both in a cooling phase, which means if it wasn't for human activity, our planet would be a whole lot colder than it is right now. So it's human activity that's counterbalanced the natural cooling that's been going on. And of course, there are other factors that affect the temperature of the surface of the Earth, but the Milankovitch cycles are a very significant factor. But yeah, right now we're in the cooling part of that trend. And if it wasn't for human activity, we'd be deep in an ice age right now.
So what's your best projection right now of when the next ice age cycle will begin?
Well, it will begin when the polar ice cap melts. And I've argued in the book that we can delay the melting of the polar ice cap maybe for as much as 1,500 years. I mean, if we do nothing to try to counterbalance the current global warming, it could happen in as little as 100 years. But there are ways that we can push it back, but we can't push it back forever. Another ice age is coming no matter what we do. And if you're premillennial in your theology, you're going to want that 1,400 or 1,500 years so that Jesus can reign for 1,000 years on planet Earth with the appropriate climate stability that we're enjoying right now. So yeah, if you're premillennial in your theology, that should give you a little more motivation to do what we can to extend the period of climate stability. But there is a limit.
Thanks.
You're very welcome. Well, with that, I'm going to stop the recording, and we'll pick this up 2 weeks from today. And feel free to tell your friends. It's free to engage this. And if we get to a point where we can't accommodate everybody, we'll take steps to increase our Zoom bandwidth. But thank you all.
And Hugh, yeah. Hugh, would you stay online with Ross and everyone else? Would you leave the meeting lower right-hand corner of your Zoom screen? Leave the meeting. And Hugh, just real quick.